Hello and good morning with Studies Through the Bible with Pastor Zach Ebar. Today we are continuing and finishing the historical books. I know you're probably thinking, oh, thank you, Brother Zach. We are so tired of going through history. But we are going to get into a very interesting final bit of history in the time of the Israelite nation. Not that we won't cover history in the other books, but we are getting closer now to the wisdom literature, and then later we will touch more into historical things with the minor and major prophets. But today we're going to be actually looking at three books that I'm sure you did not know, two of which were originally one book. And the other one that I'm sure you did not know occurred in the same time period as the other two. We are looking at Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther. And what is unique about these three books is, in all reality, they all three need to basically be put together. For the first six chapters of Ezra is going to be detailing the first return of the people from Babylonian captivity. As you remember, when we ended in 1st and 2nd Kings and 1st and 2nd Chronicles, the northern and southern kingdoms had been taken into captivity. The northern kingdom by the Assyrian Empire and the southern empire by the Babylonians. And so what happens in Ezra is we have this 70 years of Babylonian exile where we are finally allowed to leave under one of the kings. One of the ones we'll talk about, for example, is Artaxerxes, who allows Ezra and Nehemiah to return back to Jerusalem to rebuild part of the city. But before we get into all of that, I'm going to kind of give you a time flow of how these three books go together. Ezra, going to chapter 6, is the first return from Babylonian captivity under Zerubbabel. And then all of a sudden, we need to interject the book of Esther. Okay, so we have chapter 6 through Ezra, insert the book of Esther, chapter 7 through the end of Ezra, and then into Nehemiah is kind of the chronological order of all of these events. And what is so unique about these three books is they're going to take place in what I refer to as the building of modern religion, okay? And now I know what you're thinking. Now, Brother Zach, this all takes place in 600 to 400, late 400 BC. How in the world can you say that this was the beginnings of modern religion? Well, the reason for that is because at the same time all of these events are going on in the book of Ezra, we have Gautama Buddha, okay, also, as everybody just knows, as Buddha. He lived from 560 to 480 BC. He is teaching his teachings of religious beliefs during this time in India, while Confucius, who was from 551 to 479 BC, is teaching his religion in China, and Socrates from 470 to 399 BC was teaching his philosophical and religious beliefs in Greece. So a lot of these very famous religions, okay, religious people, people that you will cover even in a secular history class, if you were in high school within the last 10 years, or in college or anything of that nature, these are three very prominent names that you will see in secular history and religious history. And when I say religion, I mean false, pagan, whatever, okay? And it's for you to realize that your Bible was being created and built even the same times as these three men kind of helps to make it seem more real, doesn't it? It kind of helps to make it seem more like, okay, well, this is going on and at the same time that these three things are going on. It just kind of gives you a better perspective of just how much God has been involved and is working in the Israelite nation because these three men are taught and shown to you like they, you know, just happened 100 years ago. Whereas now you kind of have this idea, this place marker. And at the same time, God is bringing his nation back to Israel. These things are going on in the world. You can start to see the building of the stepping stones for the return of Jesus Christ during the time of the Roman Empire. So you may not feel like this is beneficial to helping you remember or understand, and that's completely okay. But it definitely shows you that at the same time God is working to progress his word, Satan is working to progress religious idealism throughout all the nations of the world. But so, backing up to Ezra again, Ezra is a continuation of what we've already seen in 1st and 2nd Chronicles. Originally, Ezra and Nehemiah were one book. They remained that way in the original Hebrew translation, and they even maintain that in the Greek translation. For some reason, when we decided to do the Latin and English translation, we felt the need to separate these two books. If you're one of those diehard, one translation only kind of people, I'm going to tell you right now, I'm going to break your heart as we're going through the rest of the Bible, as you see, where men took a lot of freedom with what they could do with the scriptures. For example, separating entire books the way they wanted to. Not that it changed any doctrinal theology, but it definitely changed the flow of your Bible. And kind of takes away from a lot of things that need to go together and probably causes a lot more confusion than anything else. But so these two books are originally together, all right? Ezra and Nehemiah. And really, there's no specific author mentioned for Ezra and Nehemiah. But it makes sense since there's a lot of first-person parts in the book of Ezra. And because Jewish tradition, or the Talmud, gives this over to being written by Ezra. We're thinking that more than likely Ezra wrote the book of Ezra and the book of Nehemiah. Now, I know what you're thinking. Well, Nehemiah has a lot of first-person parts in it. Yes, but it starts out saying these are the words of Nehemiah. So more than likely it was Ezra who not only took and wrote his own book about Zerubbabel's return, his return, but also Nehemiah's return directly from the mouth of Nehemiah himself. We also tend to think that Ezra may have wrote Esther, but based off the way Esther is written, there's some dramatic differences in style, so that may or may not be true. Either way, though, we know whoever wrote Esther not only lived in Babylon, but was aware of Babylonian culture and what was going on, amongst the people. 8 o'clock in the morning comes early, doesn't it? And so, as we're moving through this, we're kind of give you some dates for what's going on in Ezra, okay? So, just as the Israelites were taken in three different stages, movement from the southern kingdom to Judah, which was in 605, 597, and 586 BC, they are also going to return in three different stages. The first time is under Zerubbabel, and that is in 538 BC. The purpose was to rebuild the temple, but it took them a very, very long time to decide they were ready to start rebuilding the temple, and did not actually start until around 520 to 516 after Haggai and Zechariah, the prophets, came in and kind of lit a fire under their hind end, okay, to encourage them to get to work. Then almost 100 years, okay, if I'm doing the math all the way, probably about 80 years, okay, let's say 80 years. About 80 years later, under Artaxerxes I, the seventh year of his reign in 458 BC, Ezra leads the people back And this time is, you know, part of it is going to be talking about the temple and seeing the temple restored. But the main goal for Ezra is to go back and restore the spirituality of the people, to restore them to their God. They, you know, you got to remember, they're coming out of captivity in an idolatrous nation where they're allowed to do whatever they want to do. Now they've had to come back and they're rebuilding the temple to worship a God who's not going to allow them to do whatever they want to do. And to stop them from falling back into the same cycle, Ezra wants to restore wants to restore them back to being what they are supposed to be under God. And so what we have here is the end of the seventh year of Artaxerxes I, 458 BC, Ezra returns to begin this spiritual conditioning. And then 14 years later, in the 20th year of Artaxerxes I, Nehemiah will lead the final return, and that is to build the walls of Jerusalem, which remarkably, they rebuild in 52 days. Now, as I said before, chronologically, Esther fits between chapter 6 and 7 of Ezra. Those events happen in 483 to 473 BC, between the first and second return to Jerusalem. And why that's important for you to know is that what happens in Esther is an attempt for the destruction of the Israelite people. And it doesn't occur just coincidentally between the first and second returns, as they are trying to rebuild their nation, trying to re-become that lighthouse to the world, trying to become God's people again. It only makes sense that there would be those who would want to destroy them. Also, there were many who did not go back on the first return. And it's these Jews that are left to fight amongst themselves, or, you know, try to do what they can to survive when this little plot comes into action. So, first of all, I definitely think that one of the biggest purposes of Esther was to show God still taking care of his people despite captivity. But secondly, to show what happens when you don't follow the hand of God when it's leading you to do something. Every single Jew should have went back with Zerubbabel, but they would rather stay in their cushy, idolatrous lifestyle. So all of that kind of help you to get a time date of what's going on. But the theme and literary structure is very important. The book of Ezra is all about restoration. With Zerubbabel's group, it's all about restoration of the temple, okay? With Ezra's return, it is about a restoration of the spiritual, moral, and social conditions of the people. And both tasks, guys, are monumentous. You can't begin trying to get people to do the right thing without a sense of God's presence being amongst them, which was the purpose of rebuilding the temple. Do temples or church buildings have anything to do with spiritual condition? No. No, they don't. But it helps sometimes for there to be a physical symbol of who we are and why we do what we do. So the restoration of the temple, to begin re-worshiping God from a physical standpoint, is just as important to the needs of restoring the condition of the people by teaching them no longer to be religious, but rather to live a lifestyle in accordance with God's word. And it's only going to... Excuse me, I have no idea what's going on with me today. It's not only, though, a call to restore them in that sense, but it's also to help reassert the identity of the Israelites as a people that are separate from all other people to God. You know, there's times that you and I need to remember that if we don't look different than the rest of the world, then there's a good chance we are just like the rest of the world. When we're worried about things that don't matter, when we're worried about things that are irrelevant, to our walk with God, there's a good chance we are starting to lose our identity in God and start to regain our identity in the world. So, two very important things that are happening, two very important themes that are going on. To kind of give you an outline, chapters 1 through 3, we have the first return to Jerusalem under Zerubbabel, okay? And this first return is of 49,897 people from Persia to Jerusalem. And it takes, we're going to cover about 22 years of history from chapters 1 to chapter 7, okay? From chapters 3 to chapter 7, we're going to have the construction of the temple. Then we're going to get into the reformation of the people, okay? So now we're done with Zerubbabel. We're going to start talking about Ezra. Chapters 7 through 10, or through the end of the book, is all about Ezra's second return with only 1,754 people. So obviously they didn't learn in the book of Esther, did they? No. Sometimes God's people will let you down and let you down hard. That's just the reality sometimes of not only dealing with people, but of being a leader. So obviously we see these Israelites did not learn much of anything from their occurrences between these two separate returns. But chapter 7 through 9, under Ezra, we have the second return. Persia to Jerusalem, we're only going to talk about 1 year of history, okay? 1 year, 458 to 457, then we're basically done with Ezra. From chapters 9 and through the end of the book, we will also see the restoring of the people. So, what we have, my goodness, I may need to change our times. So what we have here is we cover literally 23 years of history, but the majority of it is on the front end of the book itself. And in between these two returns, you insert Esther, right? So at the between chapter 6 and 7. Now, to kind of give you a small outline, okay? Babylon to Jerusalem is quite a journey, really. It's roughly 600 to 800 miles, if I can eyeball it on this little map here in front of me. And it would have taken them quite a bit of time to move from that location all the way to their homeland. And not only would it have taken a bit of time, but also they had a lot of stuff to carry and were moving a lot of people. So what happens? And so what happens is that we have Cyrus who comes in, takes over Babylon in 539 BC, and then shortly thereafter he starts loosening up these people to go back to their homeland. Under the Persians, they allowed you to return home and to have all of your things and your ways of life as long as you agreed to pay taxes and behave yourself. And so when we're looking at Ezra, we'll talk a little bit about the actual captivity and how it came to be that they were under Persia instead of Babylon and how that actually benefited the people. Now, moving into Nehemiah. Nehemiah is, we're not going to talk about a whole lot different because of the fact that Nehemiah and Ezra basically go together. With Nehemiah, this was originally, as I said before, part of the book of Ezra. And probably really needs to be reattached to the book of Ezra as opposed to being separated. But Nehemiah is kind of a very unique guy. He's the personal advisor to Artaxerxes I. That idea of cupbearer is more than just a butler. He was more than likely in a very esteemed position. He was very well trusted by Artaxerxes, and he has a desire to take his countrymen home and to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. You cannot have a city that is burned to the ground with nothing but a temple in the middle of it. They needed to begin rebuilding. And of course, like I said, this is many, many, many years after the temple has already been rebuilt that Nehemiah gets to go back and help kind of rebuild the city and the walls of the city. Okay? which they monumentally take care of that task in 52 days. It's a very amazing thing that they were able to work so hard and so quick despite all the opposition that they received from the Samaritans and the Ammonites, okay? But so when we're looking at the author, we've already talked about the fact that Ezra is more than likely the author, and that there's also a very good chance that Nehemiah, not only is he later made governor of Judah, but he returns a few times to Persia and then comes back again to Israel. But there's a very good chance that he was a eunuch, which would explain why there is no reference to any family prior to the book, because that was common for servants of the rulers in Persia to be sterile. So what is going to happen here is we're going to talk about some dates. Dating during this time gets a little sticky, okay? When we're looking at how it is written, because there's a lot of stuff that goes on, all right? So first of all, Nehemiah is going to serve twice as the governor of Judah. His first time spanned 12 years. We see that in chapter 5. And then ended when he returned to Babylon in chapter 13. He then returned to Jerusalem after certain days. Not exactly 100% sure on when that occurs. If the king was still Artaxerxes I, then it's more than likely that this was Nehemiah's second governorship beginning around 424 BC when the king died. So the book of Nehemiah is probably written between 430 and 420 BC based on all of that. But it's very important that you understand that Nehemiah is written around the post time of his second governorship, okay? So when things would have been a little bit less sticky, when they had already accomplished their tasks, Ezra sat down and records this information. Now, as for our theme and literary structure, we still have a sense of restoration that's going on about us, okay? We are rebuilding the walls. We are trying to restore the people, okay? But Nehemiah kind of comes back and does what Zerubbabel and Ezra did separately. He comes back and he gets the walls rebuilt, and then he spends the rest of his time trying to get the people to do what they're supposed to do. Sadly, for most pastors, that's what life is all about. It's about trying to get the people to do what they are supposed to do. And so when we're looking at this, Ezra is dealing with the religious restoration of Judah. Nehemiah is primarily concerned with its political and geographical restoration, but is later deals with a lot of the spiritual conditions as well of the people. Because, you know, but guys, by this point, without walls, without infrastructure, Jerusalem is not a city, it's ruins. And so Nehemiah wants to come back and restore it back to its glory, but also help to restore a lot of other things about it. For example, there is a spiritual revival that happens where the Jewish nation is getting rid of their Gentile wives. Now, is that because God has a race problem? No. They didn't have anything to do with them being intermarried. Remember that there's two Gentiles in the bloodline of Jesus Christ. It had to do with the fact that they were idolatrous spouses. They were going to continue to cause the same problems that Israel had already run into before. You cannot marry somebody who does not believe the way that you do as a child of God and expect it to work out. You will either give in or you will end up in a divorce. It's kind of common sense to me, but for a lot of people, not so much. So we see this revival, not only of, you know, rebuilding the city, rebuilding the walls, rebuilding the political and geographical identity of the city, but we also see Nehemiah saying, look, y'all got to get your act together. Yeah, we've got the temple built, we got the walls built, we're getting the city restored, but you guys are still not getting on par. And so we do all of these things, and to kind of give you an outline of what's going on in Nehemiah, chapters 1 through 3, preparation to reconstruct the wall, It's political and it's dealing with physical things. It's all going to take place in Jerusalem, and the whole book covers 19 years of time. From chapters 3 to 8, we have the reconstruction of the wall. From chapters 8 to 11, we are renewing the covenant, which is spiritual instruction, okay? And 11 through 13 is obedience to the covenant, meaning that Nehemiah wants the people to pull their heads out and get their acts together. And so you have all of this that's going on, despite Samaritans and Ammonites going against them, overwhelming difficulties involved in building the wall, but it all gets done. Now, during the book of Nehemiah, we're going to see some very interesting thing about Persian kings, from Cyrus to Cambyses, Smerdis, Darius, or Darius, whichever you prefer. There's weird people out there in this world. Xerxes or Ahasuerus I, Artaxerxes I, Xerxes II, and Darius or Darius II. We're going to talk about a lot of these guys because there's a lot of this time period that involves all of these kings, okay? There's a lot of things that are going to happen where we are dealing with these kings. But what's very interesting is that I want to take just a brief moment to focus on Nehemiah as a servant, okay? As a servant, he prays for his people, which is because God will preserve his covenant. Chapters 1, verse 4, chapters 1, verse 5. He plans for the people, and that's because God places the ideas in his mind. We start to see this role of Nehemiah doing what needs to be done for the people and God providing the answer. He preserves them against enemies for his people, and God destroys his enemies' plans. He pleads for the unity of his people, and God is pleased with said unity, and he blesses that prayer. He realizes there's some falsehood that's going on amongst the people, and he remains faithful, and God, of course, ends up proclaiming his name among the nations with his power and his glory. Nehemiah is a beautiful picture of what every single Christian should be, which is a servant. It's too often that in churches today, people are more concerned with trying to have power or to be able to persuade what is going on, more interested in social nonsense. Churches today, beloved, it's so sad to see they're almost diminished to country clubs with the behavior of the people. Nobody wants to be a servant anymore. Everybody wants to be the one in charge. And the reality of the situation is that God is in charge of all of God's churches. We as God's people have the job to place ourselves in a position of servitude to the church and to God. And sadly, I think for the most part, pastors are the only ones that have figured this out. It's going to take the people a while to figure it out, and in many ways, the people never figure it out, as you will see under the minor and major prophets. But so, that is Nehemiah and Ezra, which should still be together in a nutshell. Now we're going to talk about Esther, and Esther is very, very, very unique. And it's so unique because of the fact that God's name is never mentioned one single time. The main character is a woman, which is very odd in the Old Testament, right? We see that with Ruth, but we don't see that very much more often than that. But we see here with the book of Esther, our main character is this godly woman who ends up being the queen of a nation. Well, one of many queens, but the wife of the Persian king, okay? Which is Ahasuerus, all right? So what we end up seeing here is a very unique period of time in the Israelites' life. And we see God's providence with God never ever being mentioned. And we see that through the places that Esther reaches, as well as through the advice and the occurrences of her very wise and very interesting cousin, Mordecai. Okay? And so the basic overall view of Esther is we have this guy, Haman, or Haman, depending on who you are. There's an argument over that too. Who wants to destroy the Jews. Okay? He wants to completely wipe them out as a people. And he convinces Ahasuerus to basically sign in laws that would allow everyone to kill whoever they want to. Okay? And so, as far as Jews are concerned. And so, our authorship, we already talked about, it could be Ezra, but we don't know for sure who actually wrote it. We know the events occurred between 483 and 473 BC, that fits between Zerubbabel and Ezra's returns. However, since the author speaks of King Ahasuerus in the past tense, it's more than likely that the actual book itself was written under Artaxerxes I. Okay? Now, historically, this book is going to unveil a segment of Jewish history that we have never seen before, and it is going to be one of the first times mass genocide has been sought after for the Jewish nation. Obviously, you know about that under Adolf Hitler. During the Nazi party, that was the goal, was to kill them all. And Haman's plot is no different. But this is the first time that we actually see a structured movement against the Israelites as a people. And so, theologically, God is going to put these people in place to help protect his people. But it's basically going to talk about the providential protection of God. We never see God actively move. We just see these people, by chance, end up where they needed to end up. And Esther, of course, is going to convince the king to set laws in place so that the Jews can defend themselves. We see the Feast of Purim come out of this. And not only that, but we also see God in general moving in these people's lives. So to kind of give you an outline, chapters 1 through 2 is selection of Esther as queen. It's a very quick book, okay? So she becomes queen. This is at the feast of Ahasuerus. And of course, there's grave danger because very quickly, chapters 2 through chapter 5, we see the plot by Haman. And then all of this takes place in Persia and it covers 10 years of time. Then from chapters 5 to chapter 8, we see the triumph of Mordecai over Haman. And this is going to incur the feasts of Esther and Purim, okay? Mordecai finds out what's going on. He helps to move the pieces around with Esther for this to come into fruition. And then from chapters 8 through 10, triumph of Israel over her enemies, meaning that when the people go to try to kill the Israelites, they're allowed to defend themselves, and they fight back and win, okay? And so a very quick book, very quick telling of historical events that occurred in the time of the Israelites. During this book, though, a couple of highlights, we're going to see a lot about Persian customs, how laws could not be changed, the Persians were typically a pretty lenient people, yet we have this guy who is a little on the crazy side that wants to kill all of them. Of course, we see a very awesome Old Testament woman, Esther, that's not really all that much talked about in church, in my opinion. If I think about it, the 23 years I've been in church, I think I've only heard somebody preach about Esther maybe twice, which is a shame. Esther's a very good book. This just goes to show pastors are also supposed to be teachers. But also, we're going to establish some Jewish feasts that you know about, but probably have never even known why they're there or where they came from. Because there's some feasts that were established in Leviticus, right? They were necessary for the people. But there are some that have been added in for important historical events. Purim is a historical important event for the Israelites. That was the first time somebody tried to kill them and they didn't get away with it. Then you have Hanukkah, right? You all know about Hanukkah. And that has to do with the Maccabean Revolt. It's the time of, you know, the Feast of Lights, okay? So there's a couple of ones that get added in that have very important historical events tied to them, okay? So, with all of that said, that is the end of the historical books. Not that we won't deal with the topic of history over the rest of our biblical studies as we're moving forward, but that we're going to have a shift in tone. We're going to be dealing with wisdom literature next week, Job, Psalms, the Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and we might try to do all four of those, to be honest, in one episode, because we can't really go into a lot of detail with those, but at the same time, we can also discuss the importance of those four books as one whole, since they are the wisdom section of the Old Testament. But so, with Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther, all three basically need to be together. The events are kind of mixed up, right? Ezra chapter 6 through in between 6 and 7, insert Esther, and then, of course, Nehemiah on the end. All more than likely written by Ezra himself. Not going to debate it with you. You can agree or not agree. It's irrelevant. But the point of the matter is that these three books help to wrap up the exile and return back to Jerusalem before we get into the wisdom literature and the major and minor prophets. And don't forget, this part of history is occurring at the same time as many modern religious movements. Buddha, Confucius, Socrates, these men that you still study about and know about today in high school, guys, they are living at the same time that all of these events are occurring. So it just kind of helps to bring that history to life for you, that it's not all fairy tales and made up and didn't actually happen. It is a historical record that as we move forward in time, you're going to start to see major historical events happening at the same time there are things in the Bible that are going on in the nation of Israel as God is moving history forward to set it up for His redemptive plan. Don't forget, of course, we got some of our bad guys' names in today. Don't forget as well, what's going on. The first return is the restoration of the temple. The second return is the restoration of the people. The third return is the building of the walls and the restoration of the people. And then, of course, in Esther, it's all about providential protection. So we're going to be dealing with some very important topics when we are getting into those books, dealing with some very interesting periods of time and things that occur in the lives of these men and women as they are helping to move the Israelite nation forward. So, with all that said, that is the end of the historical books. You have arrived. Make sure to go over these three books, look at them a little bit, read over them. If you want to start studying them, go ahead. But either way, I am Pastor Zach Ebar, and this has been Studies Through the Bible with Pastor Zach. Make sure to get out of here, go crack your Bible open, and get studying.